geography, and ecology and evolutionary biology, and a member of the UCLA Institute of the Environment. So very wide-ranging geographer and natural scientist. He got his undergraduate degree at UC Berkeley in geography, went on to get his PhD at University of Toronto in botany, and he publishes on climate and environmental change, 120 articles, and he is not surprisingly, as a result, a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Right now, he is on leave with a Guggenheim Fellowship studying the question of drought. His book, you should get a hold of, Biogeography, Space, Time, and Light, and he is, fortunately for us, about to become director of the UCLA Institute of the Environment. Thank you very much, Glenn, for coming here.
I want to thank Robert and Tom for inviting me. This is really a pleasure and an honor. It's really a pleasure to be up on the stage with Diane Liberman as well. And I thank all of you for coming out on this very, very fine and beautiful day to hear a talk about climate change. We're going to do a 1-2 punch here. I'm going to do the easy part, which is sort of lay out what might be going on with the climate and some of the what we know and some of the uncertainties. And then I'm going to leave it to Diana to do the hard part, which is what in the world should we do about all of this. So I must say, I feel I have the easy task. For someone within the climate change world, and certainly for someone outside the climate change world, it is still, to my mind, a somewhat confusing time. What to believe, what to think, and certainly, of course, what we might do. On one hand, Al Gore says we should feel a great sense of urgency because it is the most dangerous crisis we have ever faced by far. Whereas we have, on the other side, someone like Senator James Inhofe, saying global warming is the greatest hoax ever perpetuated on the American people. And so I would say somewhat divergent views on this topic. Now, these are politicians. What about the scientific community? Well, one of perhaps the leading and most elegant speakers on this, and certainly one of the most forceful in North America, is Dr. James Hansen, director of NASA Goddard Institute, a physicist by training. The difference is that we have now used up slack in the schedule for actions needed to defuse global warming. And then he goes on to say the President and Congress must act now otherwise, to defuse the global warming time bomb. Otherwise, it will be impractical to constrain atmospheric carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gas produced in burning fossil fuels, to a level that prevents the climate system from passing the tipping point, which is a very popular term being used a lot today in the popular press, that lead to disastrous climate change that spiral dynamically out of humanity's control. Okay, now that is scary stuff. On the other hand, we then have Richard Lindzen, Alfred Sloan, professor of meteorology at MIT, no slouch. All scientific issues, and this is no different, are difficult to understand. Extreme weather events are always present, and there's no evidence it's getting better, worse, or changing. Now, for some of us with a long memory, we might recall, the battle to feed humanity is over. In the course of the 1970s, the world will experience starvation of tragic proportions. Hundreds of millions of people will starve to death. That was, of course, Paul Ehrlich and the population bomb in 1968. And he spent much of his career, a distinguished career, I must say, explaining why that did not come to pass. So there are people with, one might say, valid reasons, which is saying, how much panic should we make about this particular thing? And again, I'm just putting this out here. I'm not choosing a side here, but I just want to give a little bit of the wider context. Now, we can turn then to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and their series of assessment reports. The most recent one started being published in 2007 and was number 4 in the series. Number 5 in the series is already in the planning stages and will come out in the next decade. And really, these assessment reports are the product of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of scientists
working to try to understand the climate system, what is going on with the climate system, what are the drivers behind that, how those drivers will change in the future, how this climate will change in the future. And it's typically held up as a sort of Bible, and it is a consensus report. IPCC says this is the consensus, the best consensus we can reach from a number of scientists as well as from the governments which participate in this. And since it is a consensus report, on one hand, some scientists say it's constrained by governmental involvement. It doesn't go far enough. Other scientists claim that it is constrained by ideology and it goes too far in terms of trumpeting the global change problem. One of the things about consensus is that consensus does not necessarily mean it's correct. And again, I'll just point out to you, in 1926, the American Association of Petroleum Geologists, which was considered to be sort of the leading geological group in the world at that time, held a special symposium to gather the world's geologists, paleontologists, etc., together to debate the hypothesis of continental drift or plate tectonics, which had been propounded mainly by Alfred Wegener, a German geophysicist, a meteorologist. At the end, they criticized during that meeting almost every detail of the theory and basically put it to rest for about 40 years. We now know that essentially the idea was correct, although Wegener had the details wrong, but that consensus at that time basically held back what is now probably the one of the main unifying theories in geographic sciences. So because geological science, something is reached by consensus, does not mean it's necessarily correct. I'm not saying that the IPCC is incorrect, but I think we should be careful. What I tell my students, science is not about finding consensus. Science is about finding out the truth. Now, so what do we know then? We're barraged by this, okay? We can turn on Fox and get one message. We can turn on MSNBC or read the New York Times and get another message. What is it that we do know? And what are some of what I think are the outstanding questions out there about the greenhouse gases, temperatures, and global warming? Let's go through that, and I'll look at my favorite picks for facts and then questions. First of all, it's a fact that CO2 and other greenhouse gases such as methane and nitrous oxide have been increasing. This is measured. It's based on simple chemistry, simple physics. You measure bottles of the atmosphere collected far away from cities at places like Mauna Loa in Hawaii or Alert in the Northwest Territories or in Antarctica, where you don't have a close point source of CO2 or methane or nitrous oxide. You measure how much is in the atmosphere. This has been going on since the 1950s and indeed was spearheaded by a professor at the UC San Diego. And as you can see from this trace, from the late 1950s until the year 2000 or so, it increased from 320 parts per million by volume. Today, we're up at around 380 parts per million by volume. This is indisputable. You would see an increase in methane. You would also see an increase in nitrous oxides. We know they have been increasing. No one is going to debate that. And we know certainly in the period of time that we've measured them from bottle measurements, they've been increasing. Unfortunately, we do not have such measurements, direct scientific measurements, prior to the 1950s. However, we do have little samples of the Earth's atmosphere which have been captured over hundreds, thousands, and even hundreds of thousands of years, and they are captured in ice cores. When ice accumulates in a place like Greenland, where we have deposits of ice which are old as about 150 to 160,000 years in age, or in Antarctica, where some ice deposits are over 650,000 years of age, the ice first falls as snow. Within that snow matrix, there is air. As the snow is compressed by overlaying layers of snow, the air is compressed into tiny bubbles. They are little samples of the atmosphere. Once locked into those bubbles, they remain there, and they produce how much oxygen, nitrogen, carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxides were in the atmosphere at the time, roughly when that snow fell, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, maybe 100,000 years ago. And so what do we see then from these ice archives of atmospheric CO2. Well, what we see is if we go back to pre-industrial revolution levels, levels at the end of the, let's say, the 18th century or so, we typically had around 280 parts per million by volume of carbon dioxide. And this trace here, the blue trace, that's 1860 at the beginning, 2000 here, that shows the ice core measurements of how much carbon dioxide was in the atmosphere. These are the Mauna Loa atmospheric bottle measurements. And you can see they match up pretty nicely. We think that the ice cores have good fidelity to how much carbon dioxide, methane, or nitrous oxides were in the atmosphere. We can see an increase in carbon dioxide that starts at about the time of the Industrial Revolution and indeed continues to present when we're over 380 parts per million by volume. So we do have then a long record that takes us back. And again, it suggests that this is a somewhat anomalous or unprecedented increase in these greenhouse gases, at least in the recent past. Now, we also know that for the most part, those increases in greenhouse gases can be attributed to human activity. This is, again, a fact. Most people are not going to dispute this. You can look at all sorts of measures, calculations of how much fossil fuel have been burnt, how much land has been cleared and forest burnt, how much changes in land cover have taken place, or for instance for methane, how much material has been placed in garbage pits and things like that which will produce methane. You can do calculations, mass balance calculations, or you can look at the isotopic or geochemical signature of these greenhouse gases and see that they are being produced by human activity. Major source being, of course, the burning of fossil fuels. So CO2 fossil fuel use is the most important driver. About 56% of the extra CO2 is being produced by fossil fuel use. And so we can then go and we can see that this increase, which we see over the last few hundred years, is indeed mainly and largely due to human activity, and the greatest proportion of it, particularly for CO2, for carbon dioxide, would be fossil fuel burning. So that's another fact we know. Now here's another fact. Where is most of this being produced? If we look on it on a per capita basis, Qatar is probably the leading producer. But if we actually look at the bulk amount, the total amount, the net amount of greenhouse gases in terms of CO2 equivalent produced, we would see China and the U.S. are at the top of the charts. This is data; these are data from about 2006. And then following that, the European Community, Indonesia, Brazil, Russia, et cetera, down to India. And so in the United States, we are the top of the pops along with China in terms of total amount of greenhouse gases in terms of CO2 equivalent that is being produced today. So we not only know that it's human produced, we know where it's being produced, and a lot of it is being produced right here. Now, those ice cores, as I mentioned, go back in time. They go back in time in Antarctica over 650,000 years. And so this is the result of an analysis by the EPICA group, which is a European group, which has been publishing from a very long ice core from Antarctica over the last couple of years. This is showing then from 650,000 years ago to the present day, traces for methane, CH4 at the top, and for carbon dioxide recovered from the ice cores at the bottom. And you can see, and it's a fact, that there is great natural variability in carbon dioxide and in methane. And so we can see peaks going up to around 280, maybe 290 parts per million by volume. And we can see drops where the amount of atmospheric carbon dioxide goes down to somewhere about just over 180 parts per million by volume. So there is natural variability in this system. Typically, when we have warm periods, such as we're experiencing today, we have high amounts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as well as high amounts of methane. And that actually contributes to the warming that we enjoy today. When we have ice ages, such as we did about 20,000 years ago, typically carbon dioxide and methane levels drop. That also contributes to the cooling. We don't think in and of themselves methane and carbon dioxide variations produced the timing or the magnitude of the ice ages, but they certainly are positive feedbacks that enhance either warming or cooling. So there is indeed natural variability. That's a fact. Now, since there is natural variability, you do get people such as Glenn Beck. I will reserve any further comment on Mr. Beck or his intellect, except to give you a quote. By the way, Glenn Beck recently moved from CNN to Fox. I don't know why, but now what I find interesting about this chart, the one we just looked at, is CO2 seems to naturally go up by itself. I don't remember those 200,000-year-old cars. I think Henry Ford wasn't around yet. I don't know if Fred Flintstone actually did have a car, but apparently, according to this chart, somebody was driving around in a car and airplane. Maybe it was Al Gore giving the freaking speech at Stone Age colleges. And this is the thing. So some people say, well, naturally varies. This is all part of a natural system. But there's more to the story than that. There is the natural variation over the last 400,000 years. Notice that it varies between about 180 and about 290 parts per million by volume. And this would be true if we ran this back 650,000 years. That's where we are at today, about 380 parts per million by volume. Yes, it naturally does vary. It doesn't naturally vary up to 380 parts per million by volume. At least it hasn't done it in several millions of years. And that is the point, Mr. Beck. Over the last 650,000 years, we've never seen natural variation produce such high amounts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now, the next big question is, we're adding more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Now, think about this. We're talking about going up to 380 parts per million by volume. If we look at methane, we're talking about increasing it to about 700 parts per billion by volume. These are tiny amounts. They are trace amounts in the atmosphere. So people have questioned then whether changing these trace amounts of carbon dioxide or methane in the atmosphere actually would produce any measurable or significant change in the Earth's climate. And indeed, there are certain meteorologists on TV who question this quite regularly, including the head meteorologist for CNN. If we look then for evidence that there might be some sort of temperature response to climate change, we do have fairly long records of climate station data from measured climate stations, MET stations, which are measuring climate on an hourly basis, corrected for the proximity of cities or having stations removed where cities are, because large cities produce their own warming. As population in a city grows, energy use grows, changes to the landscape occur, and warming will occur. So any city, if you have a thermometer there for 100 years as a city develops, the temperature will go up. That's the urban heat island effect. Correcting for the urban heat island effect, what we can see is particularly the late 20th century, the early part of the 21st century, there has been a movement towards higher temperatures. And these are annual temperatures from 30 degrees north and then 30 to 60 degrees north and 60 to 90 degrees north. This is measured data. These are measured data. And what you can see are a couple of interesting things. First of all, we are higher in most cases over the last two decades than the measured data show us for about the last 100 to 150 years. We typically have higher values. Values tend to be higher on an annual basis and in the winter than they are in summer. The increase in summer temperatures has not, in most places, been as significant as the increase in winter and in annual temperatures, which, by the way, would be consistent with having more greenhouse gases. If we look at the geography of warming, and this is a map showing the geography of warming from 1955 to 2005, it's not uniform. It's not uniform. You see that you have very, very high amounts of warming over the sub-Arctic regions of northwestern North America and northern Eurasia. The red bullseyes are the areas of greatest warming. And you have some areas like parts of sub-Saharan Africa, the eastern coast of Labrador and Baffin Island and adjacent Greenland, where there really hasn't been any appreciable warming. So it's easy then, if you're a skeptic, to find a station. There's not that many of them, but they are there, that show no warming over the 20th century. You can find places like that or show no really large-scale warming over the last two decades. But and because the distribution of warming is not uniform, which is very consistent with how we know the atmosphere acts. In some areas, though, you can find very pronounced warming. So we do know that their temperatures have been increasing. The question is it natural variability? And I do want you to notice that there is a dip in temperatures, typically in northern hemisphere temperatures, following about 1950 or so, and in fact very cold conditions during the 1970s. And it is absolutely true. There were papers published and discussion about in the late 60s, very early 70s, are we entering the next ice age? Because they were on this part of the trajectory. Now, so are the increases in temperatures that we see over the last few decades, and then the 20th century in general, beyond the range of natural variability? And are they human caused? These are really good questions, okay? These are solid scientific questions. And again, we only have station data that goes back to maybe, in many cases, 1900, in some cases, 1850. We don't have meteorological stations typically recording values on an hourly basis for 200, 300, 1,000 years. Our meteorological data are somewhat short. So we have to go to things like ice cores, lake sediment cores, tree rings, corals, natural deposits which capture information about the climate. And this then brings us to the very famous hockey stick, which was published in 1999 by Mike Mann, Ray Bradley, and Malcolm Hughes. Ray Bradley and Malcolm Hughes typically work with these fossil records and tree ring records of past climate. Michael Mann, mathematician, he works with mathematical manipulations of such data. And they published what became a sort of poster child for IPCC, the so-called hockey stick. And what it is it's a reconstruction of northern hemisphere temperature variation from 1000 AD to about 2000, based on largely tree rings, but later on including other sources of information about past climate. Why do they call it a hockey stick? Because it looks almost flat. There's a little peak here, little decline here, almost flat, and there's the 20th century, there's the late 20th century. So imagine a hockey stick, the sweep on a hockey stick. And so this is then put out as saying, okay, if we look back over 1,000 years, something big is going on. I mean, we're not just seeing a little bit of change here, but this is blowing past entirely. Here are the air bars in gray, the natural variability we've experienced over the 20th century. When this was published, it became extremely controversial. And there were some scientists who wholeheartedly supported it and had other empirical data which seemed along these lines. There were other groups, scientists and also, I must say, consultants for some energy firms, which went after it in a very, very large way. And this is the one that then eventually had Senator Inhofe, who was at that time the chair of the Senate Committee for Environment and Public Works, subpoenaing the records and putting out subpoenas for Drs. Mann, Bradley, and Hughes to defend this particular piece of work and the mathematical manipulations that were used to produce it. And whereas you had other people like McClintock in Canada publishing articles, you know, basically denouncing the hockey stick. And he says, we have the Energy and Environment Report that came out in 2003 that says the original Mann papers contain collation errors, unjustifiable truncations of extrapolations, source data, and obsolete data. So, and this then got beyond the realm of discussion of science. It got into the realm of, you know, public pressure on scientists and disclosure by scientists and freedom for investigation. And also, though, it did get into the realm of the responsibility of scientists to make their data and their methods transparent and readily available. However, if we then go after 2003, 2005, and today, what we find is there have been many, many studies, both collecting empirical data, more tree ring studies, data from coral, data from boreholes, data from ice cores, lake sediments, as well as climate model simulations that have tried to look at how the climate may change with increased greenhouse gases and things like that. And basically, the vast, vast majority of them tend to support then the man et al., the general shape of the man et al. Hockey stick. And here you can see spaghetti plot of many of these different studies, some of them by Mann and his colleagues, but others by other groups of individuals, showing that same general shape with the hockey stick here. Now, I do want you to notice, though, that with all of these studies, almost all of them, you have a cool period here, let's say from the 19th century back to about the 16th century, and a tendency to warmer conditions from about 800 to about 1300 AD. So there are a couple things that we can learn from this. One is there certainly is natural variability in the climate system. There's high-frequency natural variability, but there also is low-frequency natural variability. Now, the question then is that warming that we see over the 20th century really the result of greenhouse gases? Or since we know, we all agree, that there's natural variability in the climate system, whether you're, you know, Al Gore or you're Senator Inhofe, you would all agree there's natural variability. Is it possible that the warming we've seen over the 20th and early 21st century is just a result of natural variability? And it happens to be very strong, but it's natural variability. Well, one thing you can do is you can transform then amounts of carbon dioxide or amounts of methane or amounts of nitrous oxide into their radiative forcing. In other words, if we add this much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, how much actual radiative forcing, you know, increased radiative heating might it produce? And you can see that the addition of the amount of CO2 that we've put in from about the beginning of the 20th century to today, it would be somewhere about 1.5 watts per meter square of extra radiative forcing. So about 1.5 watts per meter square of excess radiative forcing. Average is about 250. Watts per meter square surface. That's the sort of planetary average. So we're not talking about a whole lot, and that then raises the question, is this enough radiative forcing to really cause these major climate changes or the warming we've seen? Now, in the IPCC assessment, they do a bookkeeping with the best physics available at this present time of the radiative forcing components, the greenhouse gases like CO2 methane, they look at ozone, they also look at changes in surface albedo, reflection of the surface due to land use changes, they look at the deposition of soot on top of snow, they look at solar irradiance, because as I'll show you in a minute, the sun is not does not have a constant irradiance, it changes in terms of its radiative properties, and they look at other sorts of controls, contrails from jets and things like that. Now when we first look at this then, what they say is the net radiative forcing from human-caused actions, taking negative radiative forcing from human-caused actions, positive radiative forcing from human-caused actions, humans are responsible for a positive radiative forcing through everything that they've done, including adding greenhouse gases, but also related to things like land clearance and land surface changes of somewhere around 1.5 watts per meter squared total with an air bar that's in the realm of about 1.5 watts per meter squared total. Okay? A pretty big air bar on that. Secondly, take a look at this is their measure of confidence in their partitioning or their bookkeeping. The first three, they have medium to high confidence. After that, it's low to medium low confidence on whether they've got those figures right. Okay? So there are still some pretty good open questions about the rate and the magnitude of forcing that we might be experiencing today. If you do look at it, by the way, the total amount of forcing, that's is 1% of Earth's average radiative forcing in watts per meter square. So this is why people are questioning, well, is it enough? Okay, is it enough that we're actually seeing the impact of these greenhouse gases today? What about the natural variability? What could be causing natural variations that would produce the sort of heating that we've seen over the, particularly the 20th century? Well, this is a study that I was, happy and honored to be a part of. It was led by Jonathan Overpeck, who is the director of the Institute of the Environment at University of Arizona, who Diana knows very well. It was looking at many of these sorts of records of tree rings, ice cores, things like that, from the Arctic regions, and looking back over 400 years to see if the Arctic has really been warming up in an unprecedented state. Because you remember the map I showed you that had bullseyes over the western Arctic in North America and over Eurasia. If the planet is heating up, we would expect the Arctic to be one of the first areas to respond and to respond strongly. That's why Jonathan Overpeck has referred to it as the canary in the coal mine for global warming. What we see here is 1600 to the year 2000. The black line is our reconstruction of deviations in temperature over that 400-year period. And what you can see is the 20th century is unusual both for the magnitude and the persistence of warm conditions. So this matches then man's findings. Okay, this would be quite conformable with man's findings. This was published in 1997, so this is prior to man's publication. And you can see there's the trace of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in the blue. It looks pretty good, but you do notice that, for instance, late 1800s to 1850, there's a decline. You also notice there's a decline in Arctic temperatures right around 1950. So it's not as though temperature is ramping up in a perfect symmetrical and linear relationship with increasing greenhouse gases. Temperature is varying around that general trend. Now here's what's interesting. The bottom diagram here shows solar variability, natural changes in the irradiance of the sun. A tiny amount of irradiance changes. We're talking about, watt per meter square or so, and most of it in the ultraviolet portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. Thank you. Okay. A tiny amount, okay, so at the top of the atmosphere, we're somewhere in the 1300s in terms of watts per meter square. We're varying at the top of the atmosphere there from about 1365 to 1368. So tiny percentage of natural variability in the output of the sun. You would see this, for instance, detected with sunspots. That's a manifestation of solar activity. But look at this. The trace explains some, but not all, of the variance we see in temperature. Now, if I were to throw these two things out to you and say, well, which one do you think is explaining global warming? Your eye would take you to say, well, probably solar variability itself. And this is now one of the areas in which there's big discussion and some debate about global warming. For want of a better word, the global warming skeptics would say, yes, 20th century has been warm, 21st century is pretty warm. However, we also know that there's been natural solar variability, and this seems to match pretty well what's going on. On the other hand, the IPCC assessment suggests that solar irradiance changes is tiny. It has a tiny, tiny, minuscule effect. In terms of geophysicists, there is a debate about this. Some geophysicists feel that solar variability is too small to have a significant effect. Other people feel that these UV changes through their interaction with the stratosphere could indeed have an impact on climate. What's my gut feeling? I think both things are involved here. And I think there's a lot of climate model results which suggest that what we're seeing right now combines increased CO2, but also there is probably an impact. The exact partitioning, I'm not sure of natural variability. But most climate model results I've seen suggest you can't get to these temperature increases just with solar variability alone. But it is a point worthy of scientific debate and discussion. Now, how do we know that tiny amounts of solar variability might actually be able to affect temperature? Okay? Do we have any empirical data rather than just looking at geophysical and astrophysical models? Well, let's go back and look at this trace of all these plots which suggest warmer conditions during the medieval period and very warm conditions today. And let's overlay that two natural factors which possibly would influence the temperature on the planet. The first is solar variability, along with changes in atmospheric aerosols and greenhouse gases, which is the red trace. The bottom is volcanic activity. When you have volcanic activity, significant volcanic activity, it throws sulfur oxides into the atmosphere. They tend to persist, and you get a cooling. So after Mount Pinatubo's eruption, there was a cooling. After Tambora erupted in the 19th century, there was a cooling. So typically after large volcanic eruptions or periods of time where there's a lot of volcanic activity, you get a cooling on the Earth's surface because of a mantling of sulfur oxides. Not from the ash itself, that doesn't do it. It's the chemical constituents. Secondly, the heat from the volcano itself, that's negligible. So when you have lots of volcanic activity, you get cooling because the optical transparency of the atmosphere decreases. What I want you to notice is, look at, there was a slight change in insolation in the medieval period, and there was a decrease in volcanic activity just by luck, just stochastically, particularly in the 12th century. And we find that that matches up with the peak in warming during the medieval period. So empirical data does suggest that although these changes in insolation are very small, particularly coupled with changes in volcanic activity, they can significantly influence climate. And so the empirical data would suggest that we cannot remove insolation or volcanic activity as drivers which could produce significant changes in climate. So then the question is, where are we heading over the next 100 years? And that is a really thorny question, because it requires us understanding how small amounts of greenhouse gas change will actually affect the climate. How much greenhouse gases will we actually produce? How much land cover change will we actually produce? I mean, to figure out how much greenhouse gases we're going to be burning in 50 years from now requires estimates of population size, population distribution, level of affluence, transportation means, industrial means, technological change. There's a whole lot of things you have to run out to try to estimate where we will be in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And over here we see then from IPCC4 the uncertainty, the sheer uncertainty in terms of greenhouse gas emissions over the next 100 years. Take a look at that. I mean, the envelope for the uncertainty graph goes into infinity there, right? It becomes exponential. There's just a huge amount of uncertainty as to where we're going to be 50 years. IPCC is giving its best guess, and there's all kinds of differences. A lot of estimates suggest that greenhouse gas emissions will start declining by the middle part of this century. Other estimates suggest that they will continue increasing exponentially after the end of the century. Some suggest that a decline might come very late in the next century. Huge amount of uncertainty. What then will happen with the planet's temperature? Again, the next trace here shows global surface warming estimates from IPCC5 using different models of societal response to climate, and then using a number of different climate models, 6 to 12, depending on what they're modeling. And you can see that best case scenario, temperature increase will be less than a degree. Worst case scenario, it'll be over 3 degrees. And then look at the error bars associated with those estimates. They're huge. They're several degrees. I mean, the amount of uncertainty is pretty incredible right now. Now, by the way, I'm not an advocate saying uncertainty means we're not going to act, okay? If you're on a car and you're thinking, well, you know, if I don't turn, I might hit the center divider, you're probably best advised to turn slightly, right? You might have cleared it, but why take a chance? And then, again, if we look at model outputs in terms of geographic distribution of the warming, we don't exactly know what it will be, but by the end of this century, it suggests the high latitudes of the northern hemisphere, they will experience the greatest amounts of warming, which is very consistent with what we've seen so far over the 20th century, and consistent then with the signature of greenhouse gas warming. Sea level change. Okay, you can imagine we have a lot of uncertainty about temperature. Well, that means that we have really, you know, another factorial of uncertainty about how ice sheets will react to it, how the hydrological cycle will react to it. And so these are estimates of sea level change from IPCC, and they range then from somewhere about 80 centimeters down to about 20 centimeters. And the envelope itself is from almost negligible sea level rise to about 90 centimeters of sea level rise. Take a look at the air bars for sea level rise projections. Again, they're massive. Okay, so but projections of 20 meters of sea level rise, that would be devastating, but it's unlikely to occur in this century. Again, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be worried about sea level rise, but I say that we should have our eyes open to the fact that there is, even within the consensus, there is a lot of uncertainty, and kudos to the IPCC for putting that uncertainty up front there. The problem is a lot of people don't actually take the time to look at that sort of thing. The other thing, which is my, of course, favorite kick for the uncertainty is, you know, how will solar variability in the 21st century or volcanic activity change all of these things? Right now, there's some evidence that solar variability is going into another sunspot minimum, a decrease in solar output. And that's typically not built into any of the forward-looking climate models. So if we have a large decline, we go to a solar minimum, we have a lot of volcanic activity. From looking at records of past climate, it's my bet that this is going to really mitigate or will attenuate rates of warming and stuff over the future. On the other hand, if we have a volcanically quiescent planet and we ramp up sunspot activity, it's going to enhance that. And again, this isn't really built in right now. We don't really know how natural variability is going to overprint what we see over the next 100 years. So that's a good question, a good area of uncertainty. Now, what keeps me awake at night when I look at all of this stuff? What do I think about? And these are two images. This is from Saqqara, Egypt. This is from a drought and famine which occurred during the Old Kingdom towards the terminal period of the Old Kingdom phase in Egypt. That was 2,200 years B.C., so about 4,200 years ago. And I mean, that is just one of the most striking and graphic things I've ever seen portraying the impact of famine. These ribs, sunken chest, you know, breasts which are hanging listless there, handout looking for something. Really unusual to see the portrayal of human misery like that in Pharaohic era carvings. This is a pictograph from southern Utah by Fremont agricultural people, carved, according to archaeologists, about 1,200 years ago, showing an unanswered prayer for rain during the period of the medieval warm period that I showed you, right around the 1100s to 12th century or so. And that then segues me into what I really worry about. I worry about what's going on right now. And if you live in California, if you pick up the paper, whether you're reading Spanish or English language, you see that we are having a drought emergency, a drought situation within the state, both in Northern California and in Southern California. And these are just a few of the headlines. And the Department of Water Resources has their own special site, the California drought site, with all kinds of hints and things on what you can do about the drought. And then they say drought year 3. I beg to differ. These are maps from May, and then the last one here is March, because that's the most latest one I could get, of drought over North America at the end of our winter water season. The brown colors and red colors and yellow colors, those are areas that go from abnormally dry to exceptional drought. What I want to show you is, this is the headwaters of the Colorado River. It's the major extra-regional supply of water for Southern California. We get 4.4 million acre-feet from there. Here's Southern California here. So this is our major extra-regional supply. This is Southern California here, our local supply. And then this is the Sierra, the Northern California, our in-state reply. Take a look, then, at what's been going on since the beginning of the 20th century. Starting in 2001, we have dry conditions in the headwaters of the Colorado River. That expands in 2002. So Southern California, Northern California, the whole headwaters region of the Colorado River is in drought. That system persists for 2003. We then move into 2004. It persists and it intensifies. 2005 is unusual. We had near record rainfall in Southern California. That's why I have this little animation. You can see it doesn't really help the upper Colorado, which stays pretty much in drought. And if we look at the beginning of the year, we started in drought and then we went into a very, very moist period. But it wasn't good for the Colorado. By May 2006, we're back into a drought in Southern California, extending into the headwaters of the Colorado. 2007, it intensifies, covers Northern California. 2008, same large geographic pattern, maybe not quite as intense. Here we are in 2009, not as intense again, but this is a March thing. I think in May we're going to see a replay of one of these other graphs. Arguably, we are into the 21st century drought in Western North America. Is this consistent with global warming? Well, first off, it's not consistent with anything we've seen over the historical record. This is a historical trace of annual precipitation in Southern California, Sacramento River flow, which represents our California water source, Colorado River flow, our largest extra-regional or extra-state river source. And you can see there are times when all three of those systems goes into drought. The most prominent recent one, the drought at the end of the 1980s to the early 1990s, 1987 to 1991, we've blown past, in terms of duration, any of the historical droughts. They typically persist 3 to 5 years. Arguably, we're into year 8 or 9 of a persistent, what I call a perfect drought. Let's just look at it in terms of our water storage capacity. This is Lake Mead, viewed from Hoover Dam. I went out in 2005 because at that point, Lake Mead had fallen down. It was maybe at about 60% of its usual level. I thought this is very unusual. I wanted to get a photograph of that. I mean, something historical. This is the bathtub ring around the lake. That's the high water mark, full capacity of the lake. You could see it. It dropped down here. I want you to notice two things. The guy, either Homeland Security or fishing boat guy here, this red line of geologic strata here. So this is capacity. I was out there taking a picture because I thought this was really exceptional. This is 2007. Okay, there's the red line. There's the fall of Lake Mead. You've got plants growing now. Primary succession going on around the rim of the reservoir. One thing stays constant. Either this fisherman is very patient or it's a diligent Homeland Security guy, but that boat is still out there. Right now, Lake Mead, less than 50% capacity, about 48% capacity. Bureau of Reclamation feels that they may never be able to fill Lake Mead back up to capacity. Questionable whether Lake Powell is going to survive. There are some estimates from Scripps Institute at UC San Diego that Lake Mead will be down to Deadpool in about the next 15 to 20 years. Deadpool means that there's not enough water to go through any of the outlets or come into Las Vegas through any of its inlets for drinking water. Now, this is quite possibly part of a larger pattern which would be consistent with global warming. This is not IPCC. This is a study which was done by Rich Seeger at Lamont Doherty, Columbia University, using 19 different climate models. 18 of them gave the same results. This is looking at the change of precipitation minus evaporation in 2021-2140 compared to 1950 to 2000. The brown areas are places that their climate models predict, due to increased greenhouse gases, that you will get increasing drought or aridity. The blue areas are areas where the model predicts you're going to be getting increased precipitation. And what you can see is increased precipitation at the equator and in the subtropical bands, about 30 degrees south, 30 degrees north, arid conditions. Not a drought, a change in a climate state. Now, Rich Seeger titled this paper, Model Projections of an Imminent Transition to a More Arid Climate in Southwestern North America. In recent interviews, he said there's one problem with the paper. It's not imminent, it's happening now. And the data I showed you from the drought monitor for the United States is very consistent with the change in a climate state for southwestern North America. But notice it's not just southwestern North America. It's across the subtropics in both the north and southern hemisphere. Why would this happen? It's really basic, simple physics. If climate is warming, okay, you have greatest warming at the equatorial regions in terms of just insulation, the amount of sunlight you're going to get high. Uplift over the equator is intensified and what's called Hadley circulation intensifies. More uplift here gives you more precipitation, particularly over the equatorial oceans. But that air that comes aloft over the equator, as warm air rises, has to eventually descend. It descends at about 30 degrees north and south latitude. That's the belt of great deserts across the north and southern hemisphere. As this descending air intensifies, it puts into place persistent high pressure systems and warm and dry conditions. And so his model, this model analysis, very, very simple, says that we heat things up, we're going to intensify Hadley's circulation, make some equatorial regions wetter, but make the subtropics much drier. If we then turn to IPCC, this is from IPCC5, this is projections of runoff. You know, how much water is there for farming, for rivers, for lakes, for drinking, etc., by the end of the 21st century. And again, the red areas and orange areas are areas where they see a drying out. And you can see it's very consistent with Rich Seeger's analysis. Indeed, some of the same models were used. They see decreasing runoff or decreasing water availability over southwestern North America, extending into parts of Mexico, circum-Mediterranean basin, Middle East, all the way over to western India, and Pakistan, and Afghanistan region. Now, that's where I've been doing my Guggenheim research then, is what's going on not only in southwestern North America, but in Egypt, in Syria, and adjacent portions of the Middle East, and along the India-Pakistan border region. Because if we want some places that are going to be tinderboxes for trouble, try the India-Pakistan border region. Then add a long-term persistent drought to that. Or how about the southern Egypt border? Or what about the Syria-Israeli Iraqi border region? Okay? And yet, both Seeger's analysis and the IPCC converge that these are areas which are going to be prone to drought. Here's the other thing which I'm not going to get into, but paleoclimatic records suggest these areas have indeed been very, very sensitive to climate-induced drought and aridity in the past. So we have good empirical evidence which suggests these are climatologically sensitive regions, and this might be happening today. That's what keeps me awake. What do we see? We see the global drought monitor for the end of 2008 showing a drying out in most of those regions, including, of course, southwestern United States. If we look at satellite imagery of vegetation health, we see vegetation health across, which is a sort of a long-term aggregate of what's going on with soil moisture runoff, precipitation, evaporation rates. We see a stressed vegetation conditions 2007, 2006, increasing stress of the vegetation, consistent with higher temperatures, higher evaporation stress, and decreasing water availability. The other unknown is how the oceans will react to this. We know that when we have a El Nino, we have wet conditions in the southwestern United States. We know when we have a La Nina, we have dry conditions. Believe it or not, there's no convergence in the climate models as to whether we're going to have a La Nina or a El Nino condition. This is a publication from Becci et al. From 2008. These are different models and empirical data on what's going on with the El Nino, La Nina system, the Pacific Ocean, based on climate models and measured temperatures. This is the equator. Here's South America. This model suggests a cooling will happen, which means our drought here will intensify as global warming continues. This is another model which suggests a warming off the coast of South America. That means we'll get an El Nino, and maybe then our drought conditions over southwestern North America won't be as bad. Here's the empirical data. This is the Hadley sea surface temperature data set for the 20th century from England. This is the NOAA sea surface temperature data set from United States. The Hadley data set suggests the cooling. The NOAA data set suggests the warming. So right now, either from empirical data or from models, we don't know what's going to happen with the oceans, and that will either intensify or attenuate the potential drought that we will have in southwestern North America. So what do I do when something happens like this? I go to Acapulco, because it's cool, kind of retro, old school. But the other reason I went to Acapulco was that there was the first time ever American Geophysical Union had its a joint meeting in a Latin American country, and it was in Mexico. And I thought this would be an ideal time, along with my colleagues Dave Staley from University of Arkansas and Jose Villanueva Diaz from the INFAP program in Durango, Mexico, to put together a group meeting of Canadian, American, Mexican, and British scientists all working on these issues of drought, and saying, what can we tell from the past about what might be going on today? And we published an article in EOS with this huge list of contributors who were the people who spoke at the session and then worked on the paper. And here's basically what we said. The top is that trace of warming, of increased insolation and volcanic activity. And there's the medieval period there, about 1,200 years ago. This is a model, Niño Cell 3. It's a model of what happened with El Niño based on a climate model. It suggests the last time we had natural warming, we went into persistent La Niña, dry conditions. The second is another reconstruction of Pacific Ocean sea surface temperatures on the eastern Pacific off North America. It suggests a decline. Again, more or less persistent La Niña conditions. This is sea surface temperatures off Santa Barbara, reconstructed from plankton living in the Santa Barbara Channel. It suggests a depression of sea surface temperatures consistent with a La Niña-type condition. This is a reconstruction of drought conditions over central western North America based literally on hundreds of tree ring sites. It suggests very, very dry conditions, persistent drought, maybe 50 to 70 years of persistent drought. These are reconstructions of the major water supply rivers in western Canada, North Saskatchewan River, the Colorado River in the interior, and the Sacramento River. These are two different research groups, our group and then a group at University of Arizona. This is from our research group here. They all suggest, particularly over the 12th century, a major decline in river flow. This is a map of the current drought, the average drought conditions from 2000 to 2007. There's that persistent pattern, Southern California, Upper Colorado Basin. This is a map the last time we had global warming, which was caused by insolation increase. The similarity is striking. So could we be into the transition to a new climate state? Absolutely. Would that state be drier? Absolutely. Is this something to worry about? If we think water rationing is bad this year, wait till the next couple of years. We also see that in by looking at past records, this was a period of time during the medieval period, much, much increased fire activity, extremely consistent with what we see going on today in western forests of North America. Let's face it, Southern California, the fire season is now a 12-month fire season in most years. Okay, that is unusual. That is a change. Question is, what are we going to do about it? Mitigation, where and how? And that's what my colleague might speak about. The other fact is that we do have to find some ways to adapt. This isn't just an issue of mitigation. According to IPCC, this is basically going to happen whether or not we start mitigation now or not. Anthropogenic warming and sea level rise will continue for centuries due to timescales associated with climate processes and feedbacks, even if greenhouse gas concentrations were to be stabilized. I think that that's a reasonable warning. Despite my criticisms about consensus science and my hopefully ability to show you some of the uncertainties in IPCC, I think we ought to take this seriously. Thank you.
Okay. Diana Liverman now is going to tell us what to do about all this.
Do you want to stand?
We're very happy to welcome Diana. She's currently at the University of Arizona on leave, lucky for us, from Oxford University, where she directed the Environment Change Institute. People in the Geography Department, I guess, are welcoming Diana back. She's an alumni here and PhD in the Geography Department. Her work focuses on the human dimensions of global climate change. Recent articles are on carbon offsets and neoliberal environmental governance. I should mention her book, a big book with other authors, an edited volume, a companion to environmental geography, came out in 2000, just came out this year from Wiley Blackwell. Diana was just appointed to the U.S. National Academy's Commission on America's Climate Choices, so the Obama, one element of the Obama effort, I guess. You have to tell us.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and it's always nice to be back at UCLA in the spring. It was a very grey year in Britain last year, so I'm happy to be in the southwest despite the drought problems, yeah. So Glenn's talked about the science and the risks of climate change, and I want to focus on the risk that our response will be inadequate, that it will have uneven effects in the developing world, and that our response and some of our responses might be undermined by criticisms from both the right and the left, that things that we're proposing to do, and I'm going to talk particularly about, use my example, will be carbon offsetting, which I've been doing a lot of work on, that some responses may be undermined by sort of overreaction and critique where there are problems that potentially they might be reformed. So there's little question that climate change policy is zooming up the agenda, especially this year, discursively at least, if not materially in terms of good responses. And this, of course, is very much associated with the change of administration in the USA. And there's some very intense and immediate debates at several levels of governance, whether it's in the state of California, the US, the EU, or internationally. And these struggles are both over science, but particularly over the policy response. So the first sort of policy frame is at the end of this year, there's going to be climate negotiations in Copenhagen. And just this last week in Bonn, there were very vigorous negotiations. We're almost at the end of the period where people are sort of staking out their positions. And one of the big uncertainties is what the Obama administration is going to do, if anything, in Copenhagen. But there's a lot of different arenas for negotiation at the moment. One, of course, is the target for emission reductions. Can the world possibly make the commitment that the scientists would suggest? Scientists now are saying 80% reduction in emissions in order to avoid in the long term some of the risks that Glenn was talking about. Now, because greenhouse gases stay in the atmosphere for a long time, we're already committed to some of the changes that he was talking about. So a lot of what we need to do now has to do with 30 years from now in order that we're not moving to temperatures of 4 degrees centigrade or 6 degrees centigrade, really disastrous potential climate changes. But we need to try and make some commitments now to reduce emissions, and people are really lowballing at the moment in terms of the sort of emission cuts that they're looking at the negotiations. There's also a whole set of negotiations that are around the North-South bargains that are being negotiated within the climate regime. And this includes trying to rethink and reform carbon offsets. I'll be talking about that. But there's also major discussions about technology transfer, particularly to large developing countries like India and China. And then, of course, there's the question of adaptation, because it might be quite mind-boggling to think about how to adapt the American Southwest to the disappearance of the reservoirs on the Colorado, but there are other parts of the world that don't have the resources to adapt. And so one of the big arenas of debate going forward to Copenhagen is how you could actually create a finance fund that would help the more vulnerable parts of the developing world, like Bangladesh or the small island states in the Pacific, adapt to sea level rise. One of the other big things that's going to happen in Copenhagen is, of course, the question about whether we're going to do a deal to protect the global forests. And I'll come back to that. But at the moment, you can't get carbon financing for not cutting your forests down. You can only get it if you grow a new forest. And so one of the big things is what they're calling the forest deal, which would, as part of the international negotiations, provide a flow of funding to countries that reduce their rate of deforestation, because deforestation, depending on how you calculate it, is responsible for 17 to 25% of greenhouse gas emissions. Now, one of the other things that's important to note about the international negotiations that, from a research point of view, make them a little bit different from a lot of the other environmental negotiations is the very heavy involvement of non-nation state actors. And I've been involved in a project with the Tyndall Center where we've been looking at how these non-nation state actors are trying to influence and the roles that they try to play in the climate negotiations. And here we're not just talking about corporations, the business sector and the NGO sector, but for example in Bali there was an enormous delegation from California. So cities and states are sending delegations to these what are basically, you know, the Westphalian nation-state set of negotiations. And I think the climate negotiations are particularly interesting because of the very large role of the non-nation-state actors. Now, the second arena that we are looking at, and this is where this National Academy Committee is pretty interesting, though I don't want to overblow the ability of any administration, even the Obama administration that says it cares about science, to actually listen to everything that a National Academy Committee would say. I have a feeling that our scientific friends like John Holdren and Major Jane Lubchenco in the administration will use the Academy report to support policy but not necessarily take everything into account. So what we've got going on in the US, and there seems to be a hearing every other week at the moment, are struggles over the target. And at the moment, the Obama administration has taken a pretty pathetic short-term target, which is just to get emissions back to 1990 levels by 2020. I don't see where an 80% reduction by 2050, which is the longer-term target, sort of fits into that, because the current target is very modest in terms of turning around dangerous climate change. There's also enormous debates about whether we're going to have cap and trade or cap and dividend or taxes or regulation, and there's lots of very different opinions about that. We don't know whether the US will sign Copenhagen, sign Kyoto, whether it will contribute to some of the international carbon trading, and whether the US will step up to the plate in terms of financing adaptation in other parts of the world. There's one other comment I wanted to make about the engagement of non-nation state actors. The two key foci of the business sector and the NGO sector going forward to Copenhagen and also within the US, the business sector is most concerned about the carbon price. What will it be? How stable will it be? And for how long? And the NGO sector is very much focused on the forest deal, because for many conservation organizations, they think it might be the last great hope for saving the tropical forests, for example, although other NGOs are much more skeptical. In terms of the US, the other thing that's going on is this very uneven landscape now of state and local climate policy, with states like California taking very aggressive positions, states like Arizona backing out of their positions, but you also have an incredibly varied landscape of cities taking on commitments, different corporations taking on commitments, and it's very complicated. And one of the reasons the business sector, of course, is asking now for a clearer statement is that capital doesn't like dealing with such an uneven landscape of regulation. Large segments of capital don't like that. And then the final example that I'll use is that of the UK, where I've spent the last 6 years working on climate policy. And here we've got a slightly different situation in terms of the policy arena, in that the UK government, where there is tripartisan support for climate policy and has been for quite a long time now, has actually got a legal climate bill that binds the government now to carbon budgets. And the originally in the climate bill, it was a 60% reduction by 2050, and it's now up to an 80% reduction by 2050, but with a much more rigorous short-term target, so that the UK government is committed to reducing its emissions by 42% over 1990 by 2020. Now, smaller country, of course, but in terms of ambition, this is a much larger ambition than the US is taking on. But the problem that's happening in the UK now is a major backlash around a lot of the different policies that the UK government is putting in place to try and reach these targets. One is the debate over carbon offsetting that I will spend most of my talk on. There's a big debate about the role of aviation, how are we going to control emissions from aviation. There is a very large backlash on renewables, where now only about 5% of wind farms that are going through the planning process in the UK are getting through because of a not in my backyard, and also the bird watchers and others who don't like wind farms. So the government renewable target is having problems because of the public backlash. And then finally, there are the resurgence of technologies that in the UK people are very fearful and skeptical of, partly because of government failures to communicate the risks in the past. And so the resurgence of nuclear as an option for a low-carbon future is starting to cause a lot of concern. And on the adaptation side, when we're talking about adapting to warming, in Europe, of course, GM, the biotech approach to buffering crops against climate change is extremely controversial, and that now is coming back on the agenda. Now, all of this is happening in an incredibly compressed period of time, both in terms of policy and in terms of scientific urgency for the response. Moving away from the policy context, there's also a set of very interesting theoretical positions that are emerging around the response to climate change, and it's a there's a much wider range than I've sort of caricatured here, but there are groups sort of taking fairly deeply held worldviews about what the appropriate response to climate change should be, whether it's reducing emissions, how we should go about reducing emissions, or how we should go about adaptation. The first I've called the Earth System Management approach, and this tends to come from the scientists, and Jim Lovelock in the UK and my colleague John Schellenhuber in Germany. There's a whole bunch of articles now being written by the scientists about the need for Earth System Management and international environmental governance that would sort of steer the planet so that it doesn't tip over any boundaries. And this is a very science-driven approach. I argue with John that it's pretty uninformed about the way international politics actually works, but it is this sort of scientists as the managers of the planet. And for many of them, they are genuinely concerned that the planet is tipping into new transitions and want to do what they can about it. And what they can see is a sort of science-driven management approach. There's an excellent paper by Karen Lovebrand that's just come out on the discourse that's around this Earth System Management approach to responding to climate change. The second major arena is one with which you're probably all pretty familiar, which is the market environmentalist approach to saving the planet, and I'll talk more about that, but this is basically, well, if we've got an externality like greenhouse gas emissions, we need to give people property rights to it, we need to set some sort of cap and let people trade as they did with sulfur dioxide and acid rain in the US. And the market, if we put a price on greenhouse gas emissions, if we put a price on carbon, then the market will solve the problem for us. There's a third arena, which is the people who focus much more on education, human agency, information, changing human behavior. And this is a large range of sort of the non-economic social scientists, although of course there are economic incentives and disincentives within that sort of approach on behavioral change. People like Nick Pidgeon in the UK is doing a lot of work looking at the role of public attitudes, the role of climate information in shifting people's behavior, both in terms of behavior in the household or behavior in terms of voting and support for new political agendas. And then the last two are sort of the two great poles of, at least in human geography, the two great poles of sort of social theory over the last 20 years, one being political economy, where people are looking at the emerging landscape of climate governance as a struggle over power and capital trying to maintain itself and look for new arenas for profit in the both the mitigation and adaptation of climate change. And people like Peter Newell has actually got a great book that's about just being written on carbon capitalism. The activist version of Peter is Larry Lohman. Some of you may have seen Larry's work on what's happening with the political economy of climate change and the response to it. But then there's also the more sort of Foucauldian approach to try to understand what's going on. And these are people who are looking at Glenn's lecture as a discourse, or as my lecture, as a discourse that is framing the response to climate change and then establishing what they would call a set of governmentalities of rules, ways of thinking, ideologies, regulations. And the two of my colleagues that have been writing some of the most interesting work on this is Karen Baxton from Lund and Harriet Bulkley, who's a collaborator of mine from Durham. Now, I've always been very eclectic in my academic career, and I would say that I'm with the group that would blend those last three theoretical approaches into what we in geography call a political ecology, where we try to understand the interaction between structure, agency, and nature, and most recently with a touch of sort of post-structural discourse thrown in to explain what's happening. But I do think that it's actually quite an exciting arena for thinking through and theorizing what's going on here, but with very practical implications, because depending on which approach one might take, one would have different perspectives on what the strategies might be and what the success of those might be as well. So Glenn's already covered this. This was just to set a sort of geographic context. If we're going to do something about climate change that involves reducing emissions, this is a different version of Glenn's graph. It's the geography of who's emitting. This is just carbon dioxide in 2005. And you can see the US and China as the world's greatest emitters, but also other countries. And so the challenge here is, how do you turn around this engine of economic growth that's driven by high fossil fuel consumption, by cement, and by cutting forests? All of these are important land uses, by eating livestock, which of course is one of the main sources of methane emissions. And the graph on the right shows you some of the geographic shifts in who's emitting carbon dioxide. And one of the things to notice here, because I think it's relevant, maybe in discussion we could talk about what the recession means for greenhouse gas emissions, because if you look at what happened to greenhouse gas emissions after 1985 in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, you can see a really steep decline in greenhouse gas emissions, and that's the result of the collapse of their economies. And I think that is a sort of a significant message here. And my argument is, rather than use the recession as an excuse not to do anything, why not say that you're going to reduce emissions, because you're probably going to get to do them accidentally or inadvertently because of the recession, and you could take credit for it. But the other flip side of that is the very steep increase in emissions in Asia, which of course is one of the ways in which people are constructing China as the sort of evil one in the future of climate change. So what have we done so far to respond to climate change? And the first quick briefing is, well, what happened as a result of the Kyoto Protocol? This was in 1997, when most countries, this one being the exception, set out to commit to reduce their emissions. 1990 was the baseline. And on average, the commitment was to reduce emissions by about 5.2%. And this is emissions of a basket of greenhouse gases, ranging from carbon dioxide to some industrial gases like HFC. As you can see, this is just some of the commitments that people made. Germany and the UK took on quite deep commitments within an EU bubble, which means that the EU said it would reduce emissions by 8% and then sorted out within the EU about who would take the bulk of those emission reductions. As an aside, politically, it's very easy to explain why Germany and UK took that position. Germany was able to take advantage of the collapse of the Eastern European economy, so they knew they could make that cut quite quickly. And Britain knew that Margaret Thatcher had just destroyed the coal unions and was shifting to gas, and so they too were able to take that emission reduction. And it's that that gives me hope that maybe we could have an aggressive commitment in Copenhagen if people are starting to see their emissions going down because of the worldwide recession. Not that I think the recession is necessarily a good thing for society, but it might be a good thing for the planet. Down at the bottom, one of the points I want to make here is scientists are recommending 80%. So this rather pathetic 5% cut that was agreed on in Kyoto doesn't even sort of touch the problem. The graph on the right, map on the right, which you can't see very well, so I'll tell you what's on it, is actually a map of how well people are doing in meeting their commitments. And for the most part, countries are not meeting their Kyoto commitments. Canada in particular, rather than being 6% below, is 24% above its commitment at the moment. Countries like Spain are far out in beyond their Kyoto commitment, even though they were allowed to increase their emissions slightly because of being one of the less developed economies within Europe. But really the only countries that are doing a good job at the moment are the UK and Germany and Eastern Europe and Russia. So Russia actually is about 30% below what it needed to be in terms of its Kyoto commitments. And this is important in terms of the geography of international carbon trade, because anybody that's gone beyond their Kyoto commitments already has a lot of hot air that they can sell to those countries that are not. So one might imagine that Canada, particularly because the carbon price is hitting a low floor at the moment, that if Canada was serious about their international commitments, they should right now be buying carbon credits from Eastern Europe, because they can buy them cheap and it will mean they can meet their commitments, because you can meet your commitment, your reduction, through carbon trading rather than making your own emission reductions. So Canada could look at how much carbon was in that 24% that they're over on Kyoto, convert that into a ton of carbon price and go out on the world market and buy some hot air from Russia. That, in principle, that's what's behind the principle of carbon trading. Now, so the first point I want to make there is that Kyoto was inadequate in terms of a 5% reduction, in terms of what the scientists would say, and that many countries are not going to make their targets, or they've got to make their target by 2012, and at current rates, they're not going to make it themselves. The only way they could make it is through carbon trading, through buying carbon credits from a country that has exceeded their target. Now, the second sort of arena I want to look at is this whole question of carbon trading. And for those of you that don't know, I just wanted to introduce you to Kyoto's flexible mechanism. So when the international climate regime established its framework in Rio in 92 and then in Kyoto in 97, the U.S., of all people, they never signed Kyoto, came in and said, we've got to have some flexibility for countries and industries to be able to meet these commitments. They should be allowed to make reductions wherever it's cheapest and easiest, even if those reductions are not in their own operations or in their own country. So a decision was made to introduce what are called the flexible mechanisms, which allow you to comply with your emission reductions through buying credits or through trading credits from other parts of the world. The first is the one I talked about, Russian hot air being sold to Canada so that Canada can meet their commitments, because Russia's done it very easily. The second is joint implementation. I won't talk about that. But the third that I do want to talk about is the Clean Development Mechanism. And the Clean Development Mechanism is the Kyoto agreement that allows an industrial country to meet its emission reduction cap by buying credits from reduction projects in the developing countries, subject to a whole set of international oversights that I'll talk about in terms of how the CDM is governed. And the CDM is basically an offset process. You offset, Japan can offset its emissions and can emit above its international commitments because it will buy carbon reduction credits from projects in Costa Rica or South Africa or China. So there's an intermediary that's very important in the CDM, which is private sector carbon companies, what I think of as the new carbon economy. And what they're doing is going out looking for cheap ways to reduce emissions in the developing world, developing a project, getting it all certified, getting a set of carbon credits that can then be purchased by an industrialized country or a firm in the industrial world. Because within the European trading, the European emissions trading scheme, it's companies that are buying these emission reductions rather than countries. And then the final flexible mechanism that hasn't yet been approved is the one they're going to try to approve in Copenhagen. Because at the moment, you can't, the only CDM projects related to forests are ones for reforestation or afforestation, where you plant a new forest. But it has been argued that it's illogical to leave out the question of reducing rates of deforestation, because you could also get an emissions reduction by protecting a forest somewhere else in the world. So this new proposal for reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation, or RED for short, would allow for a CDM-type flexible mechanism around stopping deforestation. And if you help a country do that, you could then have credits towards meeting your commitment. Now, before I go to talk in detail about the CDM and carbon offsetting, I do want to make a point about what happened in Kyoto. Because of the flexible mechanisms and because of the politics of the negotiation, we have really done a poor job of getting greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. There were a whole set of political compromises that were made in Kyoto and in negotiations in Marrakesh and other places that really reduced what I would call the material impact of international commitments. That is, how much gases came out of the atmosphere. Now, this is a complicated graphic from a paper I wrote a couple of years ago, but basically what I did here was look at how political compromise ended up with more gases being in the atmosphere than if at the Toronto conference in 1988, which is when scientists first got together and said, this is what we need to do to avoid climate change. So in 1988, we said we should reduce emissions by 20%. If that had happened, we would have taken 1.3 gigatons of greenhouse gases, the whole basket of greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere compared to 1990. But then through our 20 years of political negotiation, we kept having more and more compromises. So the first compromise was to only have the cut be 5.2%. The second thing we did in order to get people to buy into Kyoto was allow people to pick their own baseline. So Ukraine picked the baseline when its emissions were higher so that it then got a bigger drop as a result of its economy collapsing. We allowed carbon trading, and if you can buy carbon credits rather than be forced to reduce domestically, there's going to be more carbon in the atmosphere. The Clean Development Mechanism was also a safety valve that meant that people didn't have to reduce their own emissions. We left aviation and marine out of the global deal. The US didn't participate. The developing world didn't have to take on any emission reductions, which in Toronto we suggested it should, but there are lots of political and equity reasons why they didn't. And we didn't include this idea of protecting forests. So all of those sort of loopholes or political compromises meant that instead of the 1.3 gigaton less greenhouse gases in the atmosphere by 2012, we're actually going to have 3 gigatons more. So this is, and this is really just all sorts of things that were needed or were argued to be needed to get various countries to buy in, but it's left the atmosphere in a pretty bad shape. Okay, so the formal state politics hasn't done a very good job of getting emissions out of the atmosphere so far, but then there are these non-nation state actors. So we've got states like California, we've got companies like BP and DuPont. So saying, well, we'll take on voluntary commitments, even if the nation states are not asking us to take those on yet, we're willing to take on voluntary commitments. And the project that we've been doing for Kindle, which I'll just briefly mention because it makes a similar point to the point about the nation state, is we've been looking at all the non-nation state actors, what their commitments have been, and we asked a very simple question. Could you add up all these voluntary commitments and see if it added up to more or less than 5% reduction of global emissions? Is it more or less than the nation state commitments? Well, some examples of the commitments that have been made. BP said it would cut its emissions 10% by 2010 from 1990. DuPont has committed to reduce its emissions by 65%. State of California has an 80% commitment. Many of the cities in a network called ICLEI, which includes hundreds of global cities, are all committing to reduce their emissions by 60%. And in the UK, there are lots of local carbon compacts where communities are committing to reduce their emissions by 20% over the next 5 years, for example. So we went ahead and thought, well, let's all add all this up to see if this is where the solution to climate change lies. And unfortunately, we can't add it up. The governmentalities, if you like, of emissions reporting are really bad. And some of the problems that we found in terms of the incommensurabilities are that people are reporting different units. Some people aren't saying whether it's carbon dioxide or carbon dioxide CO2e, which includes all the other gases, so you don't know what their commitment is, whether it's one gas or six gases. They're using different metrics. Some people are you can't even tell whether it's metric tons or US tons or British tons often. A lot of people aren't saying what their baseline is for their reduction. They haven't set a timetable. There's very little in terms of monitoring or independent verification. One of our sources is something called the Carbon Disclosure Project. When we interviewed CDP about why they didn't have more rigorous reporting, they said the more rigorous our reporting, the less participation we'll get from the private sector, and participation is more important. So they haven't done that. There's lots of problems with geographic boundaries. You don't know whether Shell or BP are talking about their European operations, where they're forced to do it anyway because they're part of the European the emissions trading scheme, or whether they're also including Nigeria and other parts of the world. They don't tell you what the boundaries are. And they don't tell you whether they're doing it themselves or whether they're buying hot air through carbon offsets and emission trading. And perhaps most pernicious is multiple counting. So if you take the City of London, you've got the city taking claiming reductions, you've got the corporations claiming reductions, you've got individuals, you've got the UK government, you've got the ETS, and you've got Kyoto. And so you can't really add it up because they all overlap. So that's a paper where we thought we were going to have a nice, neat data figure that you could get published in Science, and instead we've got some paper that's going to be about the sort of theory of critical environmental accounting where we say you can't do it. But the point here is that I can't tell you whether the non-state actors are making a difference, really, because we haven't been able to aggregate it. But there is one way to tell if Kyoto and the whether the nations and non-nation state actors are making a difference, and that's to actually look at what's happening in the atmosphere. Now, Glenn gave you a lot of graphs of emission trends, but I think this one is important because this is what's happened since a lot of these commitments and policies like the EU commitment and like the Kyoto commitment period came into place. And this is from a terrific group called the Global Carbon Project that is doing very good accounting of what's happening to emissions from one year to another. And the key point here is that emissions have grown since 2000 in this century much faster than even the high-end scenario of the models that Glenn was showing. So that emissions grew, you can see here, between 1.3 and 1.5 parts per million per year. This is the concentration in the atmosphere from 70 to 1999. Since we started climate policy, if you like, from 2000, it's been going up at 2 parts per million a year, and in 2007, the latest GCP report, 2.2 parts per million. So we're now got emissions growing even faster than they did before policy went into place, and starting to produce scenarios. Glenn showed you the IPCC scenarios. The latest climate models out of the UK Hadley Centre that are working with these higher-end emission trends are showing that we could be at their tail of their distribution of probability is looking at more like 7 or 8 degrees centigrade increase by the end of this century if we don't do something to turn this around. And that's why a group of us is organising a workshop in Oxford that actually I realised we should invite Glenn to after the results he was showing, which is going to be called The World at 4 Degrees, that we're going to look at in September to try to get people to really think through. And we've picked 4 degrees because we figured that that's where we're heading realistically unless we do something very serious. So it'll be both worrying and interesting to explore that set of scenarios, because almost all the climate impact work to date, and I've been working on climate impacts for about 20 years now, has only looked at a world that would be 2 degrees warmer. We've never gone, the only the paleo guys have gone to those larger increases in temperature. And it's once you get to 4°C that you start to look at the collapse of the Amazon, for example, and really serious problems in terms of food security. Okay, so let me spend a little bit of time talking about some of my own research, which is about this question of carbon offsetting, because it's fascinating theoretically, empirically, and it's a source of enormous controversy right now. The US government has not decided whether they're going to allow people to offset emissions within US climate policy. The UK was going to allow offsetting and is now thinking that maybe it shouldn't, and it's because of just a whole swirl of criticisms and pro and against offsets. So let me just, for those of you that don't know what a carbon offset is, it's the button you press when you buy your airline ticket if you're feeling guilty about your carbon emissions. That's one way to talk about it. But basically, it's paying compensation for your excess greenhouse gas emissions. So whether you're an individual, company, a country, or an NGO, you can purchase a credit both with compliance credit or a formal credit out of the Clean Development Mechanism, or a voluntary credit that is developed by companies outside of the international regime, but they're the same sort of credits. You can purchase these credits. At the moment, they cost you, well, depends on which company you use. I guess it's 10 euros, so it's about $15, something like that. I think I will try submitting my offset to these guys for my flight from Tucson to UCLA and see if UCLA pays for carbon offsets. I actually got the National Academy to pay for one, but they noticed the second time I put my offset in. So, but, you know, I think the cost of all my carbon offsets last year, and I fly a lot because I've got a transatlantic life, was £1,200, so $2,000 was the cost to offset all my flights, and I've got a very big carbon footprint. It's about 6 times the US average. So how do these... Well, it depends on the price. But it varies according... It tracks the global carbon price. At the moment, they're very, very cheap. Offsets are very cheap because of uncertainty about what's going to happen in Copenhagen, because of the general economic crisis, because they need to... They borrow money to get these projects going. And political economists would argue that they're very cheap because they're taking advantage of unequal terms of trade, that the cost of labor for the projects in the developing world is very low. So, but at the moment, they've ranged, cost of carbon credits ranges for, has ranged from about $5 to $30 over the last few years. And you can now buy fair trade boutique carbon credits. I'll come to that at the end. Where you know that you're getting a good carbon offset and you pay for it. So it's like coffee. So what sorts of projects produce carbon offsets? Well, there's a whole range of carbon reduction projects that can generate offsets. So, for example, if you just take a community in Honduras where where one of my students has been working, a whole bunch of different sorts of technologies could produce reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. So you could switch people from a kerosene stove to a more efficient wood stove. You could put in a small-scale hydro plant instead of having people burn wood or coal. You could plant a forest which would absorb greenhouse gases, and that would generate carbon credits. But then there are some very large-scale carbon credit projects in China where there were industrial gases that were being emitted into the atmosphere that have very high global warming potential, can cause a lot of warming. And there's a bunch of carbon offset projects that were about capturing and destroying those gases, and they generated a lot of carbon credits that have become available on the international market. There's also really mundane things like pig farms and capturing the methane and burning it for fuel so as to stop that methane going into the atmosphere. So there's a lot and around landfills where they captured the fugitive gases from landfills, and that generates carbon credits as well. And you can carbon offsets occur formally within the clean development mechanism and then informally through the voluntary market. So this is just a diagram schematic of the different types of carbon offset projects. And one of the points I would make is that our research suggests that technology really matters, that in the critique of offsets, most people are not being nuanced about the technologies, and that certain technologies are much more legitimate and provide a lot more benefits than others do, both to the atmosphere, to communities, and to ecosystems. So let me just take a look at the growth of the carbon offset market. This is a graphic from the latest State of the Carbon Market by the World Bank. The green bar is the clean development mechanism, so you can see that most offsets are being bought and sold and developed through the Kyoto flexible mechanism. But the little yellow thing are the voluntary offset markets. This is where individuals and companies are buying their own carbon offsets through the companies like Climate Care or Carbon Neutral. I can't remember what the US companies are right now. And we've been doing a lot of work to try to theorize what's happening with offsets. So a recent article I did with one of my students in economic geography, we used a political economy approach which looked at carbon offsets as we might call a spatial fix that allows countries and companies to find a way to respond to regulation by seeking the place where it's cheapest to comply. The other thing that is fascinating about offsets is it's a creation of a new commodity. And it's a weird commodity because it's a reduction. It's not something sort of very material. You're commodifying a reduction in greenhouse gases. And there's a whole set of interesting questions about how you commodify something like that and how you make it commensurable and put it into the market. So why do people dislike carbon offsetting so much? They're under fire, and they were under fire just last week in the US Congress. We did a study on media coverage of carbon offsetting in the UK press, and in 2008, 80% of the media articles were anti-carbon offsetting. That has resulted in the UK pulling back, the UK government, which was going to allow about as much offsetting as you wanted to meet your commitment if you're a UK company under the climate bill. Now there's a proposal to limit offsetting to 30% of your reductions, though some people want it to be nothing. And the other thing that's happening is the UK government's coming in to regulate the voluntary market because of this backlash. There's also offsets in the US. So congressional hearings the other day, my view was I'm actually not completely pro-offsetting, but when I see some of the overgeneralized, rather ignorant critiques of offsets now, I sort of want to defend them, so I go back and forth. And when I looked at the congressional testimony, I really found it sort of unscholarly in the way it was presented. One of the major critics who is very thoughtful, actually, is Michael Wara from Stanford, and I'll talk a little bit about Michael's work in a minute. And then the cost of the backlash against offsets, one of the big things in Copenhagen will be reforming the CDM, the formal offset mechanism, to try to tighten it up because of some of the criticisms. But there's also people who want to reject the forest deal because it's an offset. Now, let me talk about the background to the criticism of offsets. But before I do that, let me mention why people think they're a good idea. And the first group that thinks offsetting is a good idea are the people who believe in Earth system management, who are worried about the state of the planet. And the reason they like offsetting is it's the fastest, cheapest way to intervene in the carbon cycle to get emissions down. They don't care about politics, they don't care about ethics, they don't care about economics. If we've got money to spend on greenhouse gas reductions, they want to put it into the cheapest, most effective places possible. And in most cases, that is in the developing world, partly because of terms of trade and labor costs, but and inefficiencies, but also because of the tropical forests and their rate of being cut down. And the reason they want to do that is the atmosphere doesn't care where you make your emission reduction. It's mixed uniformly. And the Earth system managers also like it because there's plenty of places to intervene if you use offsetting. You can work on a range of gases, you can use land use, and it's cheap and rapid. There are some companies who their only way to exist is to offset, and one of my favorite companies that we work with at Oxford was Cadbury's, which is just up the road in Birmingham. And Cadbury's is a Quaker company. They've got very strong corporate social responsibility. They're worried about climate change, and so we work with them to do their carbon footprint. We found out that 70% of their carbon footprint is from the methane from the cows that are right around the factory, so it's not food miles. And if you know anything about methane and cows, it's almost impossible to, or it's very difficult to reduce the methane emissions from cows. And so you can't actually be Cadbury's and produce milk chocolate and be carbon neutral. So Cadbury's is looking at offsetting as a way to be responsible from the environmental point of view, and they've now worked to develop offsetting projects in Ghana with the 600,000 people that produce cocoa for them by putting in solar energy and efficient wood stoves. And I think that's a corporation that's sort of trying to do the right thing, even in the face of this critique of offsets. Of course, you could stop eating milk chocolate, and that would perhaps be the solution, but we'd also have to stop eating meat. And then the other logic of offsetting, of course, is those of us that fly all the time and want to compensate for it, offset provides us with that opportunity. Countries like Japan, who are already extremely efficient, it's very expensive for Japan to meet its emission reduction obligations domestically because they're already so efficient. So they plan to use offsetting as a way to meet their commitments because it's cheaper for them to reduce emissions in Brazil than reduce emissions in Japan, and it does mean the same thing for the atmosphere. The second set of arguments for offsets is that they're part of the North-South bargain. Offsetting is a way that the developing countries get to get some carbon finance to decarbonize their economies, to become more efficient. And there's also arguments that offsets have lots of side benefits for sustainable development. So saving forests, good for biodiversity, efficient wood stoves is good for women and children's health. So there's people who see that side. And then finally, there's sort of the market environmentalist argument that is the economic argument, that there's also an argument here that this is about technology innovation and carbon finance can drive decarbonization in the developing world. It can help China reduce its emissions, India reduce its emissions through investing in technologies that are lower carbon. So that's the pro. Now let's look at the against, some of which you're probably familiar with. So the first critique of offsetting is that offsets are not additional. And this is a very complicated argument. I'll try to do it simply. Basically, the argument is that many of the projects that receive carbon offset financing were going to happen anyway. So they're not providing additional reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. The second argument here is that they're not additional because what they're doing is slowing the rate of greenhouse gases, they're not reversing it. Because I fly and I pay to reduce the growth in emissions in the developing world. I'm not paying to make them negative, except when I'm planting, paying to plant a forest. So in many cases, they're not additional ecologically. And another set of criticisms is that monitoring is very difficult, is that actually monitoring the emissions savings from offsetting is full of problems. Like, how do you monitor 4,000 wood stoves into Gulsig Alpa to show that you're actually delivering the carbon reductions? There's problems that are called the problems of leakage and rebound. Basically, this is if you protect a forest in one place, it's going to get cut down somewhere else because of global economic linkages. Rebound is even more of a problem. It's if you give a community cheaper low-carbon energy, like a solar panel or efficient wood stoves, the money they save, they'll spend on other carbon-emitting activities. This is a big problem, of course, here as we all start to get more energy efficient and we spend it on flying overseas. So you don't end up with an additional carbon reduction. And there was also an argument about the HFCs, the very high global warming gases. This is the ones that Michael Warren looks at. And arguing that they should have been banned. They shouldn't have been put into the market in the first place. There's a set of ethical arguments that are best associated with George Monbiot, who has called carbon offsets indulgences for our carbon sins. And this says that basically we're paying for our sins and that not only are we paying for them, we're paying for them in a sort of neo-colonial form where we're taking advantage of cheap labor and cheap land and cheap projects in the developing world, and that the transaction costs are very high. The carbon commodity chain, there's lots of people capturing value in it, and that it's not getting to the local people where the projects are being developed. There's a whole set of arguments about the dispossession of property rights, the question of whether there are property rights to carbon, but it's most clear when we talk about the forest deal and whether some of the anti-forest deal, the forest offsets, are people who are worried that this will dispossess indigenous people. And it's clear from some of the work that I and others have done that when you talk to people about what they think they're doing when they're involved in a carbon offset project, they don't realize that they're locking up their land for 30 years because it's a long term in order for the carbon credits to be generated. And then there's a whole ethical thing about the carbon cowboys. There's people out there selling carbon offsets selling the same offset several times. There are companies using offsets to greenwash. I got caught up in this because I agreed to do some advising to Land Rover, and my students got really annoyed with me because they thought I was just greenwashing the SUV industry by even going to talk to Land Rover about an offset program. If you buy a Land Rover in Europe now, they offset your first 60,000 miles of driving and all the operation costs, but does that make it okay to buy an SUV? The only reason I talked to them about it is they have got a five-year commitment to reduce emissions from the Land Rover fleet very aggressively through technology innovation. But I still think I got caught up in a bit of greenwash there. You're filming this, aren't you? I didn't say that. Okay. Don't tell them I said that. They are trying to do the right thing. Okay.
You pay for the offset?
I have not taken a fee from Land Rover. So, okay. So the final set of critiques come from the development side of offsetting, and here the critiques are that most of the offsets go to the large industrializing countries like China, Brazil, and they're not benefiting Africa. Many of the people buying voluntary or CDM offsets really were hoping that they were helping the poorest of the poor decarbonize. There are critiques that the side benefits are not being realized, that you're not seeing income or other benefits to the communities. And then there's the question about technology innovation in the north. If you've got a safety valve and you don't have to reduce your emissions domestically, then that reduces the pressure for technology innovation in the north, even though it might be driving technology innovation in the south. So, just to end with a little bit of the research results from our group, there are a whole set of interesting analytical questions that actually it's a pretty big community now. There's probably about 40 people sort of sending each other their papers and talking to each other about this question of carbon offsets. What's interesting is how they're produced, how they're commodified, how they're consumed, who benefits and who loses, and how are they governed. And this is just partly to acknowledge all of the people that I'm working with that are writing on this, but all of these are on my homepage if anybody wants to. Not all of them, all the ones with my name on are, but I can refer you to them. Most of them are just in the process of being published. And there are a variety of papers that we're doing looking at the governance of offsets. The Lund Group is doing some really good stuff on this as well, and Peter Newell. But we're also looking at some of the consumption of offsets, some of the political economy of offsets. So some of the results, one set of studies is we're trying to understand who consumes offsets. The critics say people who consume offsets are people who just want to go on being high greenhouse gas emitters, and it's companies that want to greenwash, and it's a very cynical view of who consumes offsets. So we've actually done some studies, and we've actually found that in general, the consumers of voluntary offsets are individuals and companies who are also making an overall commitment to carbon management. So they're also reducing their own emissions fairly severely. So people who don't care just don't buy offsets. It's the committed that are going into offsetting at the moment. And if you look at the CDM, you also see that that's true. A recent study by Michael Grubb suggests that the countries that are most aggressively participating in the CDM are also those with the most aggressive domestic reduction policies. Master's dissertation on corporate demand. We interviewed companies about why they were offsetting, and to sort of summarize that, the main reason that companies were offsetting was to create an internal awareness and an internal price for carbon within their companies. That's what they reported to us anyway. And then another paper that we had a lot of fun with actually was looking at how the voluntary market is constructing consumer subjectivities, where we looked at the web pages and the discourses of a lot of the companies to try to see what sort of consumers they were appealing to. And it's fascinating the way they use the images of ecosystems or of people. And we divided these consumers into people looking for a quick fix, people looking for a sort of moral sort of obligation to the developing world, and then those sort of people that were trying to make that step towards being carbon neutral. But if you look at the web pages of these various companies, you can see all sorts of ways in which they're messaging the need that you need to buy carbon offsets, and then also the way in which they're trying to show that the offsets they sell are legitimate. The second set of research is trying to look at this question of whether the CDM is actually benefiting the poorest parts of the developing world, and a lot of people are writing on this. This map is the latest map of where the CDM projects are, and you can see they're all over India, China, and Brazil, and there's hardly anything in Africa. So there's a lot of more detailed geography behind this, but you can definitely see the geographic bias. And in particular, if you look at the offset credits in the CDM that have been generated to date, more than half of them are in China, and this is where Michael Wara's focus on China and whether the CDM reductions are legitimate in China is worthwhile. So we've got this big geographic bias to certain countries, which people say undermines the sustainable development value of offsets. There's also a technology bias that I won't go into in great detail, but if you look at the graph on the pie graph, the three red circled, which is, you know, what 60% of all the offset credits to date are all in industrial gases or methane, and there's very reducing those gases, and there's very little going into energy efficiency or renewables or wood stoves. So a lot of things you think of as the most obvious sustainable development values are not currently being funded under the CDM, though that's changing very, very rapidly. think I've just got a couple more slides. So this question of additionality, there's been a lot of sort of claims in the newspaper and by activists that the majority of these offset projects were going to happen anyway, are not producing real reductions in greenhouse gases, but we're now at the point where people are starting to do empirical work. Michael Wara, with David Victor up at Stanford, has claimed that Wara claimed that two-thirds are not additional. Okay, so that only one-third is additional. I didn't put that up right. So he's basically saying that the majority of carbon offsets are not providing additional reductions, and he's got a couple of papers making that argument. Michael Grubb in the UK, there's just been a big report published by the Carbon Trust, who argues to the contrary that 80% of all projects are in fact additional. And this is important because this is where this struggle is occurring in Europe, in the UK, and in the US Congress about whether offsetting is good for the atmosphere, if you like, whether it really is helping reduce greenhouse gases. I'll leave that bottom graph for the sake of time. And then we've also tried to look at this debate about what's happening on the ground and whether offsets benefit communities. And there's a great network of graduate students now from a whole bunch of different universities who are doing particularly their master's dissertations, evaluating carbon offset projects on the ground. There's also, I've got a bunch of PhD students. And the way we do that is we read the original project documents, we talk to the project developer, and then we go to the field. And I've got one student in particular who used to work for Engineers Without Borders that goes to the communities, finds out that their CDM solar project has failed, documents it, and then fixes it for them. She's great. She's going all over Central America fixing the projects, but only after she's documented that they're working or not. But we actually do try to calculate the savings in the field, though that's where it's very difficult with wood stoves. We talk to the communities about what they think's going on, and we've been working in a lot of different countries and trying to look at different technologies, so hydro versus wood stoves versus other things, and we've also tried to look at both the CDM projects and the voluntary offset projects to see if there's a difference. And just a sample of the research results, we found that the local project managers do undermine additionality. We say, would the project have happened without carbon finance? They say, oh yeah, that just helped it happen more easily. And the moment someone says that, it doesn't count as an additional project. We have found evidence of leakage and rebound, but this is important, we found great benefits to some communities. We've definitely, but this is, some people would say this is just like assessing any other development project, that some people benefit, some people don't. But we have found benefits, jobs, cheaper energy, direct payments, but like any other development project, you're subject to local political structures. Most communities don't realize they're participating in international climate policy, they just think it's another development project. The technologies really matter, the materialities of the offset matter in terms of who benefits or what benefits. But one of the most interesting things is we found that some communities now are competing. One company will come in and develop the offset project for them, and then when they realize there's a market out there, they wait for someone to come in and offer them more for that their carbon reduction. So there's some communities in Ghana that are getting very clever about trying to sell their offsets as high-quality offsets with lots of sustainable development benefits, and look, you can photograph our children doing better from this offset project. And then they get more money if they can do it. And one of the reasons they can get more money is because of the growth in voluntary standard setting. So the last sort of set of research that we've been trying to understand is how carbon offsets are being governed. And this involves a whole set of instruments and rules and ideas that have had to be put in place to try to verify offsets, to make them commensurable. Carbon is Adam has just written a really nice paper on the commodification of carbon, where he's shown how difficult it is to abstract it, to quantify it, and to make different carbon reductions equivalent. So you're making a hydro equivalent to a wood stove equivalent to a HFC plant so that you can trade. And so the at the bottom, I've just mentioned this, the voluntary market is now self-regulating in the face of criticism and in the face of carbon cowboys. And so they've now developed, there are actually 18 different carbon standards now. The voluntary carbon standard just certifies that it's an additional carbon reduction. The gold standard says it's got lots of nice sustainable development benefits. And if you can get your carbon offset project certified as the gold standard, then you can charge about 10 or 20% more for the offsets because consumers are now looking for high quality offsets. So, summary, policy is getting ahead of careful analysis. This is this argument that tons is happening and there's a lack of theoretical and empirical work. The emissions are continuing to increase, commitments are inadequate. There's, in terms of the approach to carbon policy or climate policy, we've got some deeply held world views that are coming into conflict with each other, both in the policy arena and in the academic arena. I think there's some really interesting insights from social theory, and carbon offsets are one of the most interesting places to investigate it. And I think more than anything at the moment, we need some careful empirical evaluation. So, thank you.
Challenging presentation, very great audience, sticking to it for 2 hours. What we need to do is take a nice break. It's quarter after. Why don't we come back a little bit before 4:30, and we'll see, and we'll certainly have a discussion for a while, and we'll see how long people want to go. This is new terrain for us, so it's natural that it takes more time. Thank you guys very much. There's coffee across the hall.
Hi, how are you? Well, I am now, yeah.
I thought you were hi, how are you?
Are we supposed to talk tomorrow?
I guess we are.
Can I go across the room? I dragged him into everything.
Oh, okay. I come half.
Okay. I'm sure. Oh, well. Come on. No, competition.